Yes, so in case it's not obvious, the first two presentations are linked. They're about the same study, and we asked if we could change the order of them because we felt that the talk that I was going to give was going to set the context a little bit better for the study, and that Sally gets the best bit because she can tell you all about the findings and the results of the study. So thanks for coming. We have quite a select audience, but thank you for making it all the way down here. And I know there's a lot of competing sessions that you have to look at, so thank you for making the effort to come. Sorry, so no presenter disclosures, but I would like to thank, before I just continue with the presentation, the rest of the team involved in this study, Sally, who you'll meet next, and some of the other researchers. I'm not a pharmacist by background, I'm a social scientist. I've worked in pharmacy for about 25 years now at the School of Pharmacy in Manchester in England. And we had a very mixed team working on this project, so pharmacists, practitioners, commissioners, we had a statistician, we had an information manager who was working with big databases. So we had a really, you know, multidisciplinary team, which I don't know if it's unusual here for pharmacy practice research, but it's certainly unusual in the UK. And obviously, I think it's worth just prefacing the fact that pharmacy practice research in the UK is like, well, health services research, first of all, is the poor cousin of medical research. And then pharmacy practice research is the poor relation of health services research. So we get very little money, very little funding for research, and it tends to be very small scale. So that was what was very different about this particular study and why we felt it was worth sharing some of the findings with you, because it was much larger scale, bigger funding from a very prestigious funding source. So that's why we wanted to share the study and the findings with you. I won't go over the pictures, but I don't know if you know where Manchester is on the north west coast of England. You go a bit further west and you hit Ireland, and it's very close to Liverpool, which is where I'm from. So just setting some of the context, pharmacy landscape is very, very complex in the UK, as I'm sure it is here as well. We have a large and diverse workforce and employment market. We have roughly 47,000 pharmacists in the UK, and I know that's a drop in the ocean compared to the workforce here, but it is the third largest healthcare workforce in the UK, and we also have about 27,000 technicians as well. We have an ageing workforce amongst the pharmacists, and it's just worth mentioning that only in the context that we have a lot of pharmacists coming to the ends of their careers who did not graduate with an M.Pharm degree but with a B.S. degree. We don't have a PharmD programme in the UK, it's an M.Pharm four-year course, but previously it used to be a three-year B.S.C. And that's relevant only in terms of, you know, attitudes and being progressive in terms of thinking about research. Excuse me. Retail pharmacy is the largest sector, so about 70% of our pharmacists work in that sector. And there are, again, like here, there are a large, diverse range of organisations. So we have supermarket pharmacies, we have international chains, we have small chains, and we have independents. But the majority of pharmacies belong to large chains, roughly about 65%. So independents and small chains are very much on the decline. We also have a huge array of community sector organisations. So a few of them here have just listed, I mean the abbreviations don't matter, but National Pharmaceutical Association represents all community pharmacists, and it's a lobbying body for pharmacy in the UK. We also have Company Chemists Association, which represents the interests of the supermarket pharmacies, and then we have Pharmacy Voice, which represents the interests of the owners, the small independent owners. So when you're doing research, you know, you have to navigate your way through all of these organisations as gatekeepers. It's also worth just pointing out that community pharmacy, pharmacy in general, is very much part of the NHS in England, which, as you know, is a state-funded provider and commissioner of healthcare in the UK. But we do have devolved administrations. So, for example, prescriptions are free in Wales, but they're not free in England, and but we do have exemptions. So some of those differences are important, and it's also why we just did the study in England, because of some of those differences. We also have a huge range of commissioners of services now, so, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but we were starting this project at a time when the commissioning structure in the NHS was changing quite dramatically. So we have a whole range of commissioners that clinical commissioning groups, for example, that commission particular level of service from community pharmacies, and Sally will say a little bit more about that in a minute. But then we have another different levels of service that are commissioned by NHS England, and then again public health services that can be commissioned by our local authorities. So you have to understand, you know, that complexity in terms of the commissioning process as well when we're doing the research. And we have regulatory and professional bodies. General Pharmaceutical Council is the regulatory body, and then we have our professional body as well. And then we have a whole bunch of different negotiating bodies, professional networks. So the Pharmaceutical Services Negotiating Committee negotiates with the Department of Health and the NHS England to look at the pharmacy contract. And then the local pharmaceutical networks, they're the ones that engage with and can have their voice heard in terms of the commissioning process at local levels. So all of that is what we were dealing with at the time that the study was going on, in terms of thinking about who we needed to engage with, you know, to get buy-in to the study. The case for public health in pharmacy has been made probably now for the last two decades, roughly. There's a whole raft of white papers that came out with the government restructuring the healthcare service, and also making the point that we needed to get cleverer and more cost efficient at the way we use our healthcare workforce. And so it was looking at ways to get pharmacists involved in delivering public health services. And it culminated really with this particular white paper called Healthy Lives and Healthy People, where the government made a very, very explicit policy statement about having community pharmacies make a contribution to public health. So I think it's probably, from what I understand so far of being here in the States for about a year now, that it's probably a little bit more advanced, I think, than here in terms of recognising, you know, the role and the contribution of community pharmacies to that public health agenda. And that's largely because of all these, you know, usual headlines that you find in public health. Britain is the most obese nation in Europe. We have increasing rates of sexually transmitted infections, increasing numbers of drug users, and obviously we've got increasing health inequalities between the rich and the poor. So pharmacy was thought to provide a resource to try and overcome some of those headlines around public health. They are highly accessible. We have 11,000 community pharmacies just in England alone, and we have something like 96% of the population that can get to a pharmacy very easily through either walking or public transport. We have a huge amount of people using pharmacies every day, so there's estimates approaching 2 million visits to pharmacies every day. And we have a large proportion of adults that use pharmacies very regularly and use them for healthcare, not just for doing their shopping and getting toiletries and all the other paraphernalia that they have. And we've also very recently seen the emergence of something called healthy living pharmacies, which is a particular model of a pharmacy where the staff are trained to a higher level, and that's including the technicians as well as the pharmacists and the other counter staff. But they also have to provide a very big range of services, public health services, and they have to provide them a higher level and a more consistent level. So that's a new model that we're seeing emerge in the UK. So in terms of the study itself, I'm not going to talk at all about, you know, the aims and the methods, because Sally will touch on that a little bit later. But it's just to say that it remind you that it was an NIHR study, which is very similar to your NIH here in the US, and it was funded to the tune of about £400,000, which was by far the biggest study that has been done in the UK that's involved community pharmacy specifically. And I think the last point I wanted to make in this slide was really this issue about dealing with that political and commercial landscape that was very complex. And there was a lot of restructuring going on at the time in terms of commissioning services. So what we were seeing at the time was actually pharmacies having services decommissioned from them, because there was little evidence for patient outcomes, and a lot of the commissioners were obviously dealing with fiscal constraints, and so we're decommissioning some of those services. So we were having to deal with some of those uncertainties while we were trying to get pharmacists on board with this study. So it's just to share the challenges and the lessons learned with engaging the sector in the research programme. I did want to say a little bit about our sort of pedigree, if you like, for doing the research, because We have a long history of the unit that I worked in. We were the first pharmacy practice unit in the UK. And so we had a very long history. We had very well established connections with gatekeepers, with pharmacists. You know, so we sort of started off with the assumption that it would be relatively straightforward and easy to do this study because we had those connections. And we were very much a trusted research centre. You know, we disseminated our research to a wide range of people. And more importantly, a lot of our research did have impact on changing policy and patient care. We'd also previously set up a network of community pharmacies to do research and understood very much the barriers to doing research at the grassroots level for pharmacists getting involved in it, you know, expertise in terms of research, the busyness of a pharmacy, the throughput in terms of patients and whether that was going to disrupt normal business. So we knew all that when we started and, you know, we were very, very aware of it and very careful. But this time we were dealing with, as I say, that very complex landscape and the commercial sensitivities around dispensing volumes, around the number of services that pharmacies were delivering, that we anticipated they would have problems sharing with us with this research. We'd also, I should have said, the previous research findings, our unit had done a lot of research about job stress and workload in community pharmacies in the UK. That was becoming increasingly a problem. And we'd recently published some research that identified that stress was particularly high in pharmacies, that in the chain store pharmacies and big supermarkets. And of course, that didn't really hold us in favour with the people that we wanted to get on board, because they thought that we would obviously be blaming them for that. The research questions this time were a bit different, because they were certainly more threatening, because we were talking about things like quality and productivity, which, you know, a lot of the big chains were a bit scared of talking about. So that was different, and also the scale of the project. This was the first time we'd done a national project. A lot of our research had been very small scale or local based, and had not necessarily always been nationally representative, but this study was very much trying to achieve that, and therefore obviously get the chains involved, get the different supermarkets involved, because otherwise it wouldn't have been representative. So we felt we needed a different approach. We started very early on with including the pharmacists in the study design. So that meant, you know, obviously talking to them about the practicalities of doing the research, but also getting them involved in thinking about the design of any of the surveys, looking at validating the tools that we were going to use. So we felt that was very important to have that very, very early on. We also set up a multidisciplinary project advisory group. There were two stages to this project. We had to first do an expression of interest for the grant, and then once we'd been given the okay to go ahead, we knew that we could put more effort into getting this project advisory group off the ground. It was very, really important to us that it wasn't seen as tokenistic, so that we had involvement from people who were actually going to input into it, that had expertise, whether it was research expertise or whether it was about gatekeeping. And they had to promise to come to meetings, which we paid for, but you know, they had to really buy into this and attend. And very much not be tokenistic and be very, very purposeful in what they were doing. We also made a lot of presentations to national and local pharmacy organisations. So some of the organisations that are listed on the earlier slide, we felt it was really important to get them engaged in the project from very early on, because we knew that some of the politics involved in the, particularly the large chains and the bigger supermarket pharmacies, that, you know, we needed to go through the proper chains of command, that it was one thing to go to a regional manager, but then you had to get the area managers involved. And they might understand the project and buy into the project, but unless they could convince their superiors that the project was worth doing, we knew we would anticipate problems. And so we had to go through different levels of the organisation and different chains of command in order to get that buy-in. So we made lots of presentations, we gave people, made contact with those important gatekeepers, and we followed up personally after the meetings to clarify the aims and the benefits of the study with them, give them any opportunities to address any of the concerns they had about the study. And that went on for a long time, believe you me, that took us about 6 months, even before we even started the study. And we ultimately, through those personal contacts, made and got secured agreement to participate in the study. So what we found when we went through that particular process was that early engagement identified and addressed a few concerns, in particular terminology. We hadn't anticipated that at all at the beginning, because we were using words like productivity and quality of services and patient outcomes, which as researchers, you know, is the language that we speak, but we hadn't anticipated that that was going to be seen as very threatening to the community pharmacies. You know, it was almost like we were saying that, you know, the services you're providing are not good quality, that you can't convince us that patients get better as a result of providing these services, and actually we're also going to look at how productive you are in the community pharmacy setting. So we suddenly realised that that was coming across as very threatening, and we had to find another way of explaining the study so that we could allay those particular fears. But strangely enough, it was the issue about convincing people that we needed evidence about patient outcomes in order to convince the commissioners to actually commission these services in the first place. So we've done lots and lots of research in the past where we've mapped what pharmacists do, we described what they did, we described the difficulties they had doing what they did, but we were never in the position where we could collect evidence that said, yes, patients get better as a result of what a pharmacist does. And that's very much what this study was trying to do. So because of the decommissioning process that we were experiencing at the time of the study, we were able to say, but if you don't participate in the study and help us to collect this evidence, then you're never going to have the evidence to convince the commissioners to commission these services from you in the first place. So, you know, we were able to turn that round to our advantage. We also anticipated some negative reactions, but I don't think we anticipated the amount of negativity that we got. So it ranged from fear and negativity, but, you know, to enthusiasm as well. And that was important, because once we realised what was making people enthusiastic about the study, we could then reinforce that and go back to the people that were feeling negative and trying to allay some of those fears. So all of that got us endorsement from 4 out of 9 of the local pharmaceutical committees that we were working with, and 4 out of 9 of the multiples. It was really important for us to get the multiples on board, as I said, because we wanted a national sample of pharmacies. And we were disappointed that we didn't get all 9 of the multiples on board for some of the problems that I've just alluded to. So that meant that we then had to extend to 9 sites from 5 to maintain the sample size. We knew that participation was likely to be affected, and we did get a lower response rate for our first stage of the pharmacy survey. But we powered the study on the anticipation that we would get that volume of response because of our experience in previous work. But we got a much better response with our second stage, because we were able to build on some of the relationships and some of those meetings that we'd been to, and develop those relationships very well. So, just to finish, the very main messages for you, I guess, to take home today would be that it's important to engage with the sector from study design stage. And that's easier, obviously, in a small-scale local study, but when you're talking about a national study, you know, that just takes a lot longer to do. And you have to engage at that national and local and individual level, because the pharmacists at the grassroots level are the ones that you're hoping they're going to help you collect the data. So it's important to engage them. And it's all very well if their managers say, yes, you must get involved in this study, when they don't particularly want to. So, you know, you have to engage at all those different levels to ensure that's going to happen. Understand the political landscape, understand the commercial landscape as well. Pharmacies in the UK, as I'm sure here, are really sensitive about sharing dispensing volume information and provision of services, so we had to find a way around that. Adequate resources for the engagement stage are absolute must if you're going to do a study of this scale, because, as I said, it took us probably 6 months to get that engagement, and I think if we hadn't have done it, the study would never have started or been successful. Take care over terminology. Realise that as researchers we talk in a particular language, and we need to be able to convert that to language that is less threatening and more understandable for those people delivering the services. And I think importantly, ensure that you have endorsement from right up to the head office of these organisations, and right down to the grassroots level with the pharmacists who are going to help you collect the data. So I think, is that it? I've stuck to time. Thank you very much. I believe we're taking questions at the very end. So thank you for listening, and I'll pass you on to Sally.